This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. 100 years ago, the last passenger pigeon passed on. From flocks in the millions, this bird was reduced down to one and then none in the span of about 30 years. If the passenger pigeon was alive today, would it have met the same fate? Could we have saved it? This week, two reports came out that evaluated the hundreds of bird species in North America. Over 20 different agencies put out the State of the Birds report that looked at conservation efforts, and a study from the National Audubon Society looked at the future impact of climate change on bird populations. These reports have some good news and some bad news for our favorite birds, so let's take a look. And we also want to hear from you. Have you noticed certain birds disappearing or making a comeback in your neighborhood? Are there certain bird species that you think more deserve a bit more attention than they're getting? You can give us your State of the Birds right now, 844-724-8255. That's 844-724-8255. Let's go to our guest. Gary Langham is the chief scientist at the National Audubon Society in Washington, D.C. Gary, welcome.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
And Ken Rosenberg is an applied conservation scientist at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, John. And hi, Gary.
Hey, Ken.
So, Ken, let's start with you. The State of the Birds report looked at nearly 800 species of birds. What were some of the major trends you've seen?
Well, as you said, 100 years after the extinction of the passenger pigeon, we wanted to do an assessment of all the U.S. birds, see how far we've come in 100 years in terms of conservation. And the report card is mixed. So in cases where we've been investing a lot in conservation, such as waterfowl and wetlands, we're seeing healthy populations. We're seeing populations that have rebounded in the last 100 years. In other places like grasslands, arid land habitats, the island of Hawaii, we have a lot of concerns.
And concerns because the conservation efforts in those places haven't been as robust over time, or is there something else going on?
Well, that's true. We think that if we invested in some of the same kinds of programs that we have in wetlands, if we were able to do that in other habitats, then birds will respond positively. But these are also areas where most of the people live, where agriculture is expanding. And so in order for people to live in a world with birds, we have to come up with ways for us to live together on the planet. And we know birds will respond positively to conservation. And so we've outlined a number of things that we need to do in those other habitats.
We saw a large number of Hawaiian birds under threat. Why is this happening?
Well, Hawaii, people think of it as a faraway paradise, but as a U.S. state, it's under our watch, it's probably the fastest rate of modern-day extinctions that we're seeing on Earth. And these Hawaiian birds are under so much threat primarily from introduced species that humans have brought, everything from mongoose and cats to feral goats and insects that have carried disease. And we have a series of mechanisms now. A lot of the birds in Hawaii are already on the endangered species list, but they just have not received the attention that some of the charismatic birds on the mainland, like the California condor or the whooping crane, have received. And we have the techniques to save some of these birds now if we can protect their habitats and get some of these introduced species out of their habitats, then we have a chance to recover them.
Gary, what are some of your big takeaways from the State of the Birds report?
Well, all the things that Ken mentioned, including trying to avoid another case of Martha, so all the great success stories of the conservation movement, such as banning DDT, which gave us back our eagles and pelicans and ospreys, and restoring wetlands, rebounding waterfowl and shorebirds across North America. We all know that climate change is going to come in and make everything more complicated. So all the traditional threats are still going to be really, really important, such as habitat loss and pesticides and things. But climate change threatens to come in and cut across all species and all threats to make what was already a hard job even harder. And the Audubon Climate Report says that nearly half of the birds in the U.S. and Canada are seriously threatened by climate change. And unless we take serious and urgent action to slow its root cause, greenhouse gases, and protect the places these birds depend on today and will in the future, that we may even lose a great number of them.
That's about 300 plus different species of birds, eh?
Yeah, it's shocking. It's 314 of the 588 species that we were able to look at.
Hmm. So what's the time scale on climate change and how you think it's going to impact these species?
So we wanted to look across a range of timeframes this century. So we have maps from 2020, 2050, and 2080, and look across a range of future emission scenarios. So one of the problems of projecting into the future is that, you know, we don't know how good a job we're going to do of curbing greenhouse gases and how much globalization we're going to have in the meantime. So we looked at a high emission future, a medium emission future, and a low emission over all those timeframes and over all those species. And what this does, if you look at it all together, is give us a sense for which of the species are most sensitive to shifts in climate we can expect. And even better, it tells us where we might take action to protect them.
Name for us some of the birds that you think might be under threat, maybe some birds that people know very well from their backyards.
Yeah, absolutely. So backyard birds like purple finch and evening grosbeak are on the list. And iconic birds that everyone knows, like the bald eagle and the brown pelican. And state symbols like Baltimore oriole, wood thrush, and you know, maybe even more important, there's a whole suite of birds that we don't tend to spend a lot of time on because they're not on a current list, yellow-headed blackbird, American avocet being two.
We're talking about the state of the birds and also a new report on climate change in bird populations in North America. If you've got questions, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at Cy Fry. Let's go to some questions because a lot of people want to ask about birds. Adam's in Elkhart, Indiana. Hi, Adam.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
Yeah, they were talking about the appearance of more birds. It seems like around here in the past 10 to 15 years that there's been an abundance of predatory birds. I think such as the red-tailed hawk. And I don't know if that's due to removal of their habitat or that they're actually reproducing and you know, in larger numbers than they have been in the past. Because before, it seemed like you hardly ever, you know, once in a great while you'd see one if you were out in the county or you know, even in a city. But now it seems like I could, you know, see one once a week.
There's hawks all over the place. Well, let's go to Ken Rosenberg. What do you say to Adam in Elkhart, Indiana?
Well, that's a great observation. And, you know, one of the success stories maybe that we can't really take credit for is the way that the birds themselves adapt. And we're seeing this all over the country, especially with hawks and owls, red-tailed hawks and Cooper's hawks, and even some of these fantastic falcons that are coming in from the north, like Merlins and even peregrine falcons. They're nesting more and more in cities. We put a nest cam up right on the Cornell campus on a red-tailed hawk nest, and it was named Big Red, and it was just so incredibly popular, and everybody was looking in on the intimate behaviors of these red-tailed hawks. And the famous pale male bird that a whole book and a movie was written about in New York City sort of started this. But it's true. A lot of these birds that you would think might be in trouble from human activities are actually adapting pretty well and moving into cities and taking advantage of the pigeons and the rats and abundant food supply there.
Well, that's one of the things, Gary, I wanted to ask you about, though. As we see birds adapting to places where they now have to live because of how humans have encroached, then we see movement because of climate change. Are we ending up with birds in places maybe they shouldn't be, competing for the same food sources, competing for the same habitats?
Sure. Well, one thing we can certainly expect is that climate change is going to bring increased disruption with species on the move, trying to track their climate space as it shifts. In fact, a few years ago, Audubon released a report that showed that nearly 60% of wintering birds in North America had already shifted north by many miles. The center of their ranges had already shifted to date. And now we still haven't even come close to seeing the real impacts of climate change with the trajectory we're on. And so what we can expect are lots of new species coming in contact with each other that hadn't before. And you can imagine that a grassland bird like the bobolink that is well adapted to, you know, open ranges and open places, if it tracks its climate space through 2080, it will be right over what is now the Canadian boreal forest. And one has to wonder, what in the world is this grassland bird going to do? And how is it going to thrive when it, if it tracks its space in finds itself in the boreal forest? What's it going to eat?
Are there certain birds that you think are going to do very well in this new world of warmer temperatures, Gary?
Well, it's hard to say. So if half the birds are at risk, then half the birds were climate stable, which meant that they weren't at risk from the direct impacts of the climate. However, when other birds move in or other species, because it won't be just birds, right? As the birds go, so does everything else. It's going to be really challenging to try to predict and understand how all these new interactions are going to lead to unknown consequences.
Ken, do you have some thoughts on this as we see habitats change, as we see humans move into new places and birds ending up in places they've never been before?
Well, we already are seeing that. And one of the things that we're talking about that's really underscored here is the importance of people going out and recording these observations. And we have a number of programs now, the eBird program that has hundreds of millions of birds observations in the database, and the Christmas Bird Count and the Breeding Bird Survey that were used in both of our reports all rely on volunteer birders making these observations, and that's how we're able to see these changes. So we already are seeing a lot of movement already in birds changing the timing of their migration and some birds staying further north. And we wouldn't have this information if there weren't millions of bird watchers out there sending that information in.
And I know a lot more bird watchers wanted to give us a call. We're going to take a quick break. Ken Rosenberg and Gary Langham are both with us. You can join us 844-724-8255 as we talk about the state of the birds here on Science Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking this hour about bird conservation and the state of the birds in North America. Gary Langham is one of our guests. He's chief scientist at the National Audubon Society in Washington, D.C. Ken Rosenberg is an applied conservation scientist at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. We're going to get to some of your questions as well. One of the reasons that we're talking about this, though, is this big State of the Birds report, 100 years after the passenger pigeon went away. Ken, tell us a little bit about this. It's kind of an amazing story. There were about 135 million passenger pigeons in the mid-1800s, and then just, a couple decades later, there were none. That's a staggering decline. How did that happen, and how can we prevent something like that from happening again?
Well, that's really the key question, is what have we learned since then? I mean, the numbers, some people say there were single flocks that were 2 to 3 billion birds that darkened the sky for an entire day. So nobody had any idea that something that abundant could disappear. And even when they were disappearing, people thought, well, maybe the big flocks just flew out west, because they didn't really have the networks and the scientific observations in place at that time. So, it's a great reminder that it's not just the super rare birds that we need to be concerned about, and we do need to try to prevent further extinctions, but we also need to keep common birds common on the landscape and preserve the abundance and the spectacle of bird migration and the common birds, because the passenger pigeon was not a rare bird. It would not have been on our watch list. It might not have even been on our radar at all as a bird that was threatened. But because of the activities of that day, mostly unregulated market hunting and exploitation, they were so efficient at killing these birds on their nesting grounds and on their roosts that they depleted the entire population in less than a person's lifetime. And we don't think that is likely to happen today, because people are watching. And we've got these monitoring programs, and if something like eBird had been in place 100 years ago, there would have been a lot more warning signals of what was happening with the passenger pigeon.
Let's go to John, who's calling from Santa Barbara, California. Hi there, John.
Hi there. Thanks for letting me ask a question.
Of course. What's your question?
Regarding the California condor, I was wondering if you could comment on the successes or failures that have been encountered in trying to save this magnificent bird in the Grand Canyon, and whether there are some serious challenges going forward.
John, thanks for the question. Ken, you want to take a crack at that?
I know that they've had some success, that there were birds released into the Grand Canyon, and for the first time, pairs of birds that, so all of the California condors had been brought out of the wild into captivity because there was the fear that they were all going to die and the bird was going to become extinct. And the only hope was to create a captive breeding population and try to clean up the environment and find some areas where they could release these birds where they would be relatively protected. And the Grand Canyon was one of those places. I'm not exactly familiar with, you know, all the ups and downs there, but I know there are free-flying birds in the Grand Canyon. There also was a small population released in Baja California in Mexico, and I think for the first time this year, a pair of birds produced young in the wild in Mexico.
Hmm. Well, birds like the California condor and charismatic birds like, of course, the bald eagle got a lot of attention. Gary, what about some of the underrepresented birds, the birds that we don't think about too much but maybe are under some threat?
Yeah, you're referring to the little brown jobs, as they say. Yeah. So, yes, there are all the charismatic birds, but when you can imagine that when we're talking about 314 species, it really cuts across, you know, so many different kinds. And one that comes to mind is the Baird's sparrow. It's actually a very handsome bird, but doesn't stand out a lot. And that, unfortunately, is one of the species that is projected to lose as much as 99% of its current breeding range. And they breed in the same area as up to 18 different grassland species. And not only climate change is threatening it, but also it just happens to breed in the same area where all the Bakken Shale oil and gas exploration is going on right now. And so, you know, this is one of the birds that gives us pause, and we really need to focus our attention and watch these birds carefully. The good news about reports like ours, that despite all the complexity of trying to project the future, is it gives us a sense of which species are most sensitive and allows us to watch them in real time to see how they're doing.
You have any good recovery stories, maybe birds we haven't heard that much about but that are doing much better than they were maybe just a couple decades ago?
I think, well, generally, I think the story of waterfowl and shorebirds recovery is a great testament to how when people take concerted action to bring back birds that were, you know, pushed to the edge of extinction through overhunting, by restoring the wetlands, there was a tremendous response of birds like mallards and pintails and shorebirds like avocets. To that restoration. And in fact, it reminds me of a restoration event that we did when I was in California, where there was an area in San Pablo Bay that had been dry for decades. And when we brought in the heavy machinery to let the tidal flow in for the first time, we thought it might take, you know, weeks or months for the birds to come back. But as soon as the water rushed over that land, the birds came in and landed instantly. It was really astonishing.
Let's get a call here from Scott, who's out in California. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I was noticing here that a lot of birds that used to be have their range was much lower in elevation have come up here, including scrub jays, for example. And also, my 86-year-old father has noticed that there are tons of ravens that have shown up. And since they've shown up, it seems like the number of robins that used to be a very popular common bird in our area have been decimated. Now there's only one pair that we've seen around all year.
Hmm. In Europe, in Northern California?
Yeah, near Mount Shasta.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much for the phone call. Ken, what can you say about some of his reports?
Well, those are interesting observations. Common raven could be one of the most successful birds in the United States right now. Where I am in New York, ravens were completely gone from the east up until about 30 or 40 years ago. There was a small population in the Appalachian Mountains, and since then they've spread, and now they're nesting right in Ithaca, New York. But as you say, the success of some birds could affect others. Ravens are predators. Robins are doing pretty well as well, so I wouldn't worry about them too much. But the observation about scrub jays is also interesting because as Gary was talking about with climate change, not only are birds moving north, but they're moving up in elevation. And that's one of the concerns, that birds that are limited to high elevations also have nowhere to go, perhaps, once their range disappears. But some of the birds from the lowlands could end up in the mountains.
Madeline is in Mayfield, Kentucky. Hi there, Madeline. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for having me on the air.
Yeah.
A technician with Kentucky Fish and Wildlife. Project. Learn Bob White.
And Madeline, we're losing your line a little bit. I know that you wanted to ask about conservation, and that's sort of where I want to leave our conversation here with Gary and Ken, and maybe get some thoughts about keys to conservation in the future. What are some things that our listeners who are calling in right now and care about birds, what are some things they can do? What are some things you think government can do? Gary, I'll start with you.
Sure. The Audubon report is clear that we all have to take action right now. And the good news is we can do it as individuals. And even though our individual actions don't sometimes feel like they add up to very much, because greenhouse gases are cumulative, they really do. It's also important that people realize how much power they have to call their elected officials in the places where they live and say, hey, what's your plan to avoid this calamity that is going to be facing birds, people, and our planet? And you know, finally, we need to come together, groups like Cornell and Audubon and all the state agencies and federal agencies to protect the natural systems that birds rely on.
Ken, how about you? What are some thoughts that you can leave our listeners with?
Well, I heard the caller mention the word Bob White. I think she was trying to get that question in, and that's a great example of a bird that has over 90% of its range on private lands. And a lot of the conservation, whereas public lands are very important and protected areas are very important, a lot of the conservation that needs to happen now is on private lands. And this cooperative collaboration between private landowners and government, taking advantage of programs such as in the Farm Bill and other programs. And there's an entire conservation initiative centered around the bobwhite quail because it's one of the birds that has lost over 90% of its distribution. And it's going to rely on farmers and ranchers and private landowners to take these measures to try to restore some of the habitat on their working landscapes in order to preserve a lot of these birds, because there isn't a lot of land left for strict protection. So it's going to really rely on partnerships and collaboration between all these different entities.
Ken Rosenberg is an applied conservation scientist at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. Thank you so much, Ken.
Thank you.
And thanks to Gary Langham, who's chief scientist at the National Audubon Society in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much, Gary.
Thank you.